You are listening to the Hirschsprung's Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprung's disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprung's with a positive message throughout.
Hello and welcome to episode 42 of Tom's Hirschsprung's podcast. I've got a unique one for you today and we'll find out why he's unique a little bit later on. But this week I am joined by firefighter and chairman of Samuel Smiles, Samuel Bell. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you very much. Nice to be on here and I appreciate everything you do as well for Hirschsprung's podcast. So yeah, thank you very much for having me on.
No problem. No problem at all. Thanks so much for coming. And we'll get straight into it. Well, we will talk about what Samuel Smiles is a little bit later on and how you fell into sort of being a firefighter as well and your other jobs. But we'll start, if I may, from the beginning. So when you were diagnosed at birth with total intestinal Hirschsprung, so sort of total colonic, is that correct?
So it's actually more severe than total colonic. So basically, it's called total intestinal Hirschsprung disease. So basically, I have no nerves in my intestinal tract, basically. So I've only got, 12 centimetres of functioning bowel. I don't have a colon that got taken out when I was like 3 or 4. And then it's affected like my whole small bowel as well. So I have only 12 centimetres that works. It's like the most severe case of Hirschsprung's that I think you can get.
Definitely. I've learned over the last sort of 8-9 months or so, all of the different types of Hirschsprung's and whatnot, and still then I meet people and I go, oh well, I still haven't heard of that.
Right.
So I'm learning all the time. So it's great to have, and as bad as it might have been for you at times, it is great to have even more rare people because it means I learn a lot more and the audience has a lot more. So. It's bad for your suffering, I understand, but the rest of us learn a lot more. So thank you, I guess, in a way.
I know.
So you were diagnosed at birth, and then reading a lot of your articles, which are in the Daily Record, and we'll talk a lot about those a little bit later on. You were given just 3 months to live. How did that sort of come about?
At the beginning, so basically my mum's pregnancy was completely fine, so I have an older brother called Martin, so he's 5 years older than me, and he's completely healthy. So my mum's healthy, and my brother's completely healthy. My dad had short segment Hirschsprung's when he was born, so he had a pull-through procedure when he was still like a baby. I'm pretty sure that he had one of the first pull-through procedures in America when he was like a real young baby. So he obviously didn't remember it, but he still like obviously got his scar and everything. So when they had Martin, they didn't know if Hirschsprung could be passed down, and then Martin was healthy, so they didn't suspect anything when they were having me, because Martin was like, they had no issues with Martin. And then when I was born, almost instantly I just started like projectile vomiting everywhere, and then my mum didn't really know what was happening. So I was born in Inverclyde, which is a hospital in Greenock, which is like, it's not like the main hospital in Glasgow, and kind of like one of the hospitals that's like outside of Glasgow where people go and like have babies, and it's not even got a children's ward in it. So I got transferred basically immediately to York Hill, which was the main children's hospital in Glasgow. And then I spent the first 11 and a half months of my life without being discharged at any one time. So I was in there for almost the whole year. And they didn't really understand what it was. They didn't know if it was cystic fibrosis. They were unsure what it was. And then they were doing lots of testing, and it took them a bit to actually figure out that it was Hirschsprung's disease. Because back then it was like so rare to have Hirschsprung's. So I was born in 98, and then we had a doctor called Mohammed Holbourne, So that was my doctor when I got transferred over to York Hill, and he ended up speaking to different professors and all that around the world, in Canada and everything, and that's where they got the Hirschsprung diagnosis, because they didn't think it was Hirschsprung because it was so severe. That's why they didn't think it was Hirschsprung, because usually you have some bits of functioning, Bill, where when you were going in and looking at my anatomy, and there was like none, like there was just no functioning, Bill, at all. So then that's when they kind of gave me the, I think that's when they kind of gave me the 3 months, like, life expectancy. They didn't even think I would make it to there. That was like best case scenario, they were kind of explaining to my parents. And then the doctor, Mohammed Holden, who I'm still in contact with, he now lives, and after when I was 3 months old, he ended up actually moving to Abu Dhabi to be one of the head paediatricians over there. But he ended up doing a surgery on me, which is now done almost all over the UK now, called a myectomy, basically. So where they kind of go and cut a lot of the, like, the dead bowel away and a lot of the nerves and stuff like that. So children nowadays in Glasgow will get that done, like, right away when they're born. But I didn't get that done until I was about, I'm going to throw a time out here, I think it was about 2 or 3 months I didn't get that done for. But that's, it was Mohammed who was trying to figure out how to do this operation, because he got told from America about it, but it had never been performed in Europe at all, like, ever. So he spoke to the surgeons and the professors in America who had done it, and it had went well, and some not so well, and tried to figure out how to do it. So came to the proposal to my parents and mentioned about doing this operation, because he thinks it would give me the best possibility of life, because if not, then you basically can't leave all that dead bowel just sitting inside you, because it will just, like, just cause problems and basically, like, rot away and you just pass away, basically. So he wanted to do that operation. My mum and dad said yes. And when he went to all the other surgeons, because obviously this was going to be about like a 12-hour long procedure, like it was going to be really long, he put it to all the surgeons in the hospital, and every single one of them said no, that they wouldn't go in to assist him because they needed another set of hands, because they all said basically you're going in, you're just fighting a losing battle, and the kid's just going to die on the table, basically. So like, just not to do it. So he ended up finding I think he was either a registrar or a junior doctor at the time who agreed would go in with him to help him and assist him. And he is now the head consultant for urology and stuff like that, I think it is, in the Children's Hospital now. We still know him. So he agreed to go in with Mohammed when he was just like a reg, to help him, because all the other doctors said no, they wouldn't go and help him. And that surgery was obviously successful. It lasted like 12 hours, and I'm still alive 2 hours after that operation now. So that was kind of the start of my journey. And then he was like kind of like family. He would always come in every day and come over, and she would be there some first thing in the morning to come over and see me and how I'm doing and stuff like that. So he was like really close to us. And then he delivered the sad news that he was leaving to go to Abu Dhabi, because he basically got a job over there. But we still speak to him, and I've been over to Dubai a few times and seen him, and he came over to Scotland a few times, and I'm going over next March to see him again. So if it wasn't for him, I would not be here because of that operation. But now that operation pioneered for so many other Hirschsprung kids that are all born, they get that operation. The quicker the better, because it gives your body a better chance to adapt and stuff. So that was obviously a good outcome, and it's nice to see that so many other children get that done now as well.
That's fantastic. What a fascinating story as well, that you were one of the first or pioneers to have that particular operation. And there was one part that did confused me slightly, because I didn't know that your dad had short segment.
Yeah.
So when you started presenting Hirschsprung's like symptoms, was that because it was so severe that they didn't think it was Hirschsprung's?
Yeah, because it didn't keep anything down when I was like literally anything. So like my mum tried to feed me as soon as I was born, took that, spewed it right back up, and it wasn't it wasn't like it was just bile, like it was just pure bile that was coming up. So they didn't understand why that was just repeatedly happening. And then I went across, obviously, to York Hill and got put on TPN within the first couple of days of my life. And then I went in, got a stoma, and then got Maggie Shostomy to put in, pardon me, to drain, obviously, my bile, because I was just producing bile content, like, constantly, even though I wasn't getting anything in or that. I was just continuously being sick, like, 15, 20 times a day. So they just did not understand why that was happening, because if it was Hirschsprung's, then it shouldn't have been severe. If it was Hirschsprung's, then I should just be having, like, a build-up and stuff. I wouldn't have been able to go to the toilet. I wasn't going to the toilet anyway. Like, I never passed anything. I never passed meconium or anything when I was born. So they knew there was obviously something, like, blocking down there, but that's why they thought about cystic fibrosis and everything else, because they thought it was a blockage, like, that was stopping something from going down. So they didn't... My mum said that she thought it was Hirschsprung's, like, when I was younger and when I was born, she thought that it was maybe something to do with that, but I don't think they thought it was Hirschsprung's because it was so severe. And then, obviously, when they took me in at a few days old, there was no... Like, they could only see, like, a very short amount of actually functioning bile. The rest of it was just dead. So that's why they didn't... That's when they were like, we don't know what this is, because back then it was... You'd seen Hirschsprung's on the scale of short segment and stuff, obviously, and maybe and long segment, but they'd never seen it to the extent where there was nothing that was working. So that's why they were a bit confused, and it did take them quite a wee while to actually get it properly diagnosed, because they just didn't understand what it was. And it was a professor in Canada who we know of was the one that said it probably is total intestinal Hirschsprung's disease. So because it's so rare in the UK, like, even now, off the top of my head, since, like, I've been born, there was another girl who was called, Abigail, when I was about seven, I want to say maybe six or seven, and she had total intestinal Hirschsprung's disease, and she was, like, I can still remember a lot of times with her, but she ended up passing away of liver failure, due to the complexities of TPN, basically, called TPN. Even though it's starting to get a bit better now with, like, smoth and stuff and the fish oils and everything, like, back then, like, it's just toxic chemicals, basically. And that's what I'm on, like, ever since, versus total parental nutrition, because if I don't have that, I wouldn't survive. So I've never ate in my life. So I've got a line that goes into my heart, because I don't eat. So I kind of always describe it, if you can imagine, like, a tube of toothpaste, where you, like, look at a tube of toothpaste and it, like, kind of pulses, like, when you're squeezing it, so, like, the toothpaste comes out. But the way that my bowel works is I've not got any nerve for it to actually pulse, so, like, it basically just sits there like a rock. So if I have anything, like, food wise or anything like that, it'll just hits a rock and comes right back up and I'm sick. So that's because I have no bowel really that functions at all. So that's why I'm on TPN, and I have been since I've been 2 days, like, a day or two old. So Abigail had passed away, so she was the first total intestinal in the UK that I'd heard of, that we knew of from Glasgow. And then now, there's two girls that we know of in Glasgow, and then there was a wee boy that called William, and we were close with his family in England. He unfortunately passed away. I'm trying to even think, it must be like 5 years ago or something like that, I want to say. Well, before COVID, actually, I think. Don't quote me on that, but he ended up passing away. And then there's another girl with total intestinal called April, and she lives in England. So out the top of my head, there's me, Zoe and Amber, that's so about five of us in the UK that I know of. There might be more, don't quote me on that. So there's five. That's how rare, like, total Hirschsprung's is. Obviously there's loads of long segment, total colonic, and short segment. My son has got total colonic, so an ultra long. So, like, there's so many different variations, but total was like so rare to come by. So because TPN back then was so harsh on your liver and harsh on your organs and everything like that, they try to obviously stay away from being TPN dependent, like, for life. But I have been since I've been 2 days old, basically. So, yeah, so that was kind of that. And then I spent the first 11 and a half months in the hospital when I was born. And I saw lots of different infections and everything else. And then my mum and dad took over my care, doing my lines and everything, because obviously we were told, but my mum was originally told I would never leave the hospital, like I would always be in the hospital. There would be no way that you'd be able to do this at home because of all the EPN and drugs and bacteria fluid and everything. My mum used to take me over to like Ronald McDonald. I don't know what you're the Ronald McDonald is. You have that in England, don't you?
Yes, yeah. I always get messages from people saying you need to talk more about the Ronald McDonald, and I always forget. So I'm really glad you brought that up because that reminds me to talk.
Oh yeah. So like when I was born, my mum was from Dunoon, so they had a house in Dunoon, which is to Glasgow is like an hour. It's like an hour and over an hour, so it's like you can go to it by a ferry or you can drive around the roadway, like the road. So it's like an hour and a bit away. So my parents got told obviously I would never go to Dunoon, like I wouldn't be able to live there because it's too far away from the hospital. I'd need to live within a 15-minute vicinity of the hospital if I took unwell. So when I was born, within a couple of months, my mum and dad ended up selling their house in Dunoon and moved. But they lived in Ronald McDonald since I was like put into York Hill. So they lived there for like 11 months. And then they managed to get a house in Knightford, thanks to they got a council house from back then. It was the First Minister, Donald Dewar, who basically, my mum ended up contacting like the local MSP, like local councillor, for that area, and said that we needed a house because we wouldn't have been able to get home. And then we got a council house. But they lived at Ronald McDonald, and my mum used to take me over in the pram with like the free, I don't know if you know, like the free IVAC, like the big massive pumps that you would be on, like in the hospital. You know how you go in and like it's got the big pumps that run the fluid through and all that. So they used to be like the size. Oh, I'm trying to even think about the size of them in comparison. I explain that. Like, honestly, it was like the size of a TV, like half the size of like a 32-inch TV, I would say. So I was on three of them when I was younger. So my mum used to attach them to the pram to then push me over to Ronald McDonald to get out the hospital. That was the furthest we could go. But Ronald McDonald were amazing, and soon on down the line, when I had my boy, we were in Ronald McDonald for 10 days as well. So I got to experience Ronald McDonald from an adult parent's side of things. And they're amazing. Like, they don't get enough praise from what they do because they are just absolute lifesavers for family. I would also met so many families as well that have used them, from people up north that come down to Glasgow. A lot of people come down to Glasgow because it's like the centre for children's hospital in Scotland. So yeah, that used to be like my day out trip when I was a wee baby. And then my mum fought the hospital to get trained on to do my intravenous lines and stuff. So the nurses used to like take her around to the treatment room like in secret and teach her how to do my lines, to try and teach her how to do it so they could hopefully try and get me home. So my parents were the very first people to ever get IV trained, to actually be able to take me to get home. And I got home for 11, when I was 11 and a half months. I got home for like 3 days and then I was back in the hospital with a temperature. But they were the very first people to actually do TPN at home. Back then it was never heard of that you would be able to get home. But they managed to fight and they done that for me. So then we got home. First few years of my life were a struggle, obviously, just with temperatures and just not taking well. And Once my mum and dad took over my care, they wanted to do it because the amount of infections I was having, like line infections, because it was being handled by different nurses, as you can imagine. And once they started doing that, then my infections went down dramatically. I've not had a line infection since I've been like three. So I'm now 26. So yeah, I've not had a line infection. I think it's even longer than that, to be honest with you. So probably 24, 25 years or something since I had my last line infection. And that's just a credit to my mum and all my mum and my dad, and then also me when I moved out when I was 18. So I've done it every day since then as well. So it was a lot of first when I was born and growing up, and then I was the first to go home in pumps. Obviously, like, that was never a thing. So my mum had like these free IVACs attached to the wall, like in the house. So like they were hanging up, and then I could only go like a meter from the line, obviously, to be able to play and stuff. So yeah, looking back at photos of it, it's absolutely mental that like it was like that, because nowadays it's like portable pumps that everybody has in their backpacks and stuff. Which again, like, my dad went over to an American conference in America and seen these portable pumps and managed to get ran by the chief executive in the hospital, who we knew really well, Jonathan Best, about going to this big massive conference called the OLE conference in America, where basically everybody that's got gut problems and stuff go to. So last year they just had a convention, there were like over 500 families that attended it. It's like the biggest attended conference in America for people with like short gut and everything. So my dad got the go ahead from the chief executive when I was younger to go over to see it, and said if there was anything that would benefit the hospital and children with on pumps, then buy it and bring it back over and we can learn about it and stuff. So my dad went over with a credit card from the hospital, and brought back the first intravenous pumps that were used, portable intravenous pumps that were used. So as you can imagine, it went from the IVACs that were like half the size of a TV screen to a portable pump that could fit in your hand. So if it wasn't for the hospital sending my dad over and I was thinking of the idea, then we got the first portable pumps that people were able to use in Scotland. So yeah,
it's fantastic. I imagine that some people are quite happy when they're the first to do something or the first to have something. Does the novelty wear off as you've had so many firsts?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimising your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavourful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
That's funny. No, I wouldn't say so. I think it's just, I always view it as things like, I always view that I went through so many challenges and things in life, but it's for the better of so many other children that are following me. And like, I feel kind of like privileged that I was able to do that, don't get me wrong, it was obviously tough at the time and everything that you go through and that, but even like the myectomy and everything when children are born, and like knowing that stuff like that happened because you went through that, and Muhammad did that operation and like portable pumps and all that, and getting home and people getting like IV trained. Like back when I was younger, there wasn't GI teams. So there wasn't like the teams that were specifically for kids with intestinal problems or anything. We were just under the surgeons. So like there's people like the nurses and stuff, like the GI nurse in York Hill, used to say to my mum, and said at that party we were talking about earlier, like if it wasn't for my mum and dad, then they wouldn't have had a job. And that wouldn't have been set up in the hospital, because it was my mum and dad that actually came about with the idea, because they were doing all of this in America, obviously. In America, they were a lot more used in Canada to catering for children with gut problems. But because it's so rare in the UK compared to the population of the North America, obviously, it wasn't like required and it wasn't needed. So when they started having crops up of different children with gut problems, that's when they started doing it, because we'd mentioned about it. We would run it by everything with the surgeons, and the surgeons would be like, yeah, that's fine, because the surgeons literally were just like my mum and dad. My mum and dad would obviously, every decision that they would take to them, it was always well thought out of, and they would always spoken to other families that, once we spoken, we got to know other families in America and Canada through my mum, back then going on the internet and writing letters back and forward to everybody and stuff, in America, finding more information out and stuff. So that everything that we decided to do was obviously valid from children and families that have had experience and they went through this in America. So they kind of just always went to the surgeon and said, I think we should do this. No, yeah, that's fine. And then that was kind of, well, now it's like you've got the GI team and they take forward. But don't get me wrong, the doctors are there, but the parents and the families are always no better. So,
yeah. Well, you're there day in, day out, aren't you? And speaking of, you mentioned helping people and obviously being the first and you being the pioneer. You seem to have helped people or wanted to help people. It's been a passion of yours your entire life. And I'd like to move on, if I may, to Samuel Smiles, which you created in 2006. So you must have been, around about 8 years old when you created that?
No, it was 2016. Yeah, 2016. So it was for, was it? Yeah, it was, because it was for my 16th birthday. Oh, now you're going to make me do maths here. 2014, that's when it was. 2014 was when my career started.
I misread it. It said it began thinking about setting up the charity in 2006. Sorry, I misread your website.
No, it's fine. I had a surprise 16th birthday party, but we'd been talking about doing it for a very long time. It was just because I'd always grown up being so rare. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I had the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and I could apply for that, and we went to Florida for a week, which was amazing, back in 2010. So that was brilliant, and we loved it. But when it came to charities out there for kids with rare diseases, there wasn't really many. There's one called the Family Fund, where we'd be able to go on a caravan holiday once a year. But out with that, there wasn't really any charities that you could apply for that were specifically for rare diseases. And don't get me wrong, the charities out there that are for the heart, lung, cancer charities, they all do amazing works. I'm not discrediting that at all. But it's just because you're so rare, you don't fall into any other categories. And that's what I kind of thought of and realised when I was growing up. Not because I was I want to get more things or anything. It wasn't that at all. I was just that, thinking of other children and going, when they're growing up, because they're so rare, they can't apply for certain charities. And the Make-A-Wish was amazing, but you can only apply for that once. And obviously, understandably so. So that was the one thing I was a bit So on my 16th birthday, which was a surprise party, my mum surprised me with starting up the charity Samuel Smile. And that was basically for kids with rare diseases, basically. They called it Samuel Smile because after my mum, I've always been known for my smile, because even after all my operations and all that, they would always say, oh, you're still smiling and stuff. I've always been like that, no matter what. I just always say everything's fine and I'm still smiling. I'm just I think that's a figure I'm just thankful to be here, because there's been so many health scares throughout my life. Like, I was listed for a transplant when I was 6 years old and went into organ failure, liver failure and everything, so and been close to death quite a lot of times. So I've just been thankful that I'm still here every day. So that's why they decided to call it Samuel Smile. And the aim was to basically give other children a smile. So that was why we called it that. No, my mum called it that. I didn't really have much to say. So and that's been going now for, that's been 10 years this year, which is scary. And it's been great. We've helped over like 200 families. Like, we take them on days out, and they're in the hospital and stuff. If they need anything, we take them toys. But it's also like the support aspect as well for Samuel Smile. Like, we know so many different families that we support them and help them. It's not just about like gift buying and stuff, which is a major part of for the kids. Like, don't get me wrong, obviously, like, that's what the kids want. They don't really, like, they obviously like enjoy it when I go up to the hospital and sit and spend time with them and stuff. And it's obviously because you're able to relate, because you know that I've been through it. When I was younger, I didn't have that luxury of knowing someone that had went through things. When I was younger, we went over to that OLA Foundation. So my dad went 1 year, and then we went the following year. Like, I managed to go over the next year and met so many other people that had like the same condition as me. So like, there's one. I started about to say boy, but not a boy now, he's a guy. We all are. There was one guy called Roy, and who, I was just over in America last month, so we managed to meet up with him. So we talk all the time. So he is now, he won't be happy, but he's now 30, well, he's 36. So he's 10 years older than me, and he's got total intestinal hearstrung. So he's the oldest in the world with it. So he's 10 years older than me. I think he only has about, I want to say about 17 or 19 centimetres that works. But he had called over there, called Gaytex, but over here it now came over called Teriglutide, which basically stimulates the growth of your intestines for the nerve to work, basically. So he'd been on that for a long, long time. But he said to me when we met up, he'd now been off TPN. It was either 10 or 15 years, it was one or the other. So he completely eats 3 meals a day and everything. And it's like this drug that he's been taking over there for that long. And he'd been completely off his TPN. And then there's another guy who I still speak to quite often called Patrick, and he's from Canada. And he is, I'm not going to put an age on him because then he'll bite me that the fact that I've given him the wrong age, but he's a few years older than me. He's not as old as Roy, but he's a few years older than me, and he just had a son as well. Our sons were only like 8-9 months apart, and he's got total intestinal hearstrungs as well, but he is on full TPN, but he eats 3 meals a day. He doesn't get any nutritional value from it, but he does eat, but he's still on TPN every night. So we're the three old ones. There was a boy Chris, and unfortunately he passed away a few years ago. And he was roughly around the same age as me as well, but he sadly passed away. We're the three oldest total things. And then there's a lot of younger ones that have came up, but as far as I'm aware, there's not any that are older, and within like the 10-year age gap between us, there's quite a significant age. So like me at 26, and then I think the next one is like Zoe, and she's in high school now. I'd need to double check that, but there's nobody near like over 15, if that makes sense. So there's still quite a big gap there. But there was Abigail, who was there when I was sick, but she passed away. So there's quite a big gap between the rest of us. But anyway, so the reason I started Samuel Smile Up was to help other families, and that's the reason why I've done it. And it's still going. So it's been great. We go on big days out. Families want to go away for a weekend, and we provide support and help them financially, or we do that for them so they can go away and get time away. But it's not just for the kids as well, it's for the families and the siblings as well, who often sometimes get, not forgetting about, but the majority of the attention goes on if the main child, who's obviously suffering from the condition, so it's about making sure that the whole family is included. We're about to do another a big Christmas get together in December, and that will be the first time that we've gotten together since COVID, because there was so many, we kind of didn't do anything for a very long time because of all the children are so complex and so like autoimmune suppressed and everything. So we're looking forward to hopefully doing that in December, where that will be the first time we're able to get all the 50, 70 families that are currently support together. So that'll be good.
That'll be fantastic. That'll be brilliant. And if anyone wants to read those stories, there are several on your website. I've seen lots of stories about going to see Disney on Ice, going to see various football matches as well. So if anyone wants some really nice, heartwarming stories from your charity, they are all on your website. And I'd like to, as we sort of reach just over the halfway mark, I'd love to talk about your current role, as you are a firefighter at the moment. So you've got sort of helping people with Samuel Smiles to continue to help people with firefighting. There's definitely a pattern to your career. Would you like to mention a little bit about that?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena-sensitive care pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena-sensitive care pads with the skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So it's called firefighter, but it's like in the control room. So like you're in the control room, basically. Like, so I answer all the 999 calls, but that's like the small part of our job. It's really hard to explain to somebody because it's like it's not a call center, it's a control room. So like we are responsible for taking the calls, and then while you're on the phone, you're also typing the address into the system. You're also then selecting the right appliances or the right fire engine to attend to this, to go to the incident. So we need to kind of get them out the door before we've even hung up, and then we're in charge of making sure that the old liaise messages back and forth to the control room to us, so we'll record all the logs, and then we essentially, everything that goes on behind the scene from an incident is basically down to us. So they'll go and do the physical firefighting, but we're the ones that are creating the calls, making the incident, sending them on our way, making sure they go to the right place. How many fire engines are going? Do you need specialist resources to go? And then also on top of that, all the different officers, if officers need to go, they just need to be informed of it. So it's a very complex job, and a lot of people think it's just you answering 999 and that's you and that's it done, which I was silly enough to think that's what it was. But yeah, so I've been in there since January, and this had been my first full-time job. Because just to do duty health and everything else, I still do my charity work, obviously, on the side of that, but I didn't think I would be able to hold down a full-time job just with my health and everything. But I wanted to give us a try. So I've been in since January. I'm trying to think. Yeah, since January I started my training. It was 14 weeks. And then now I've been in my physical job now since April. And I'm loving it. It's been great. It's definitely challenging, but I think because of my life experiences and stuff with everything that I've been through, it's felt really natural going into this role. Being able to be on the phone, and when people are in, sometimes people are in like the worst scenario that they've been in their life, and their houses are burning or their houses are on fire. People are trapped inside their house and the houses are on fire and they don't know what to do. It's about staying on the phone, keeping them calm, comforting them, supporting them, telling them what to do, making sure that they know that you're on the phone and that you're going to get the help that they need. And it's, yeah, when stuff like that, it's really rewarding. I had a call when I was like a full family, like a family of five, was stuck in a flat and like three floors up. There was a fire in the close and they couldn't get out. And that was at like 2 o'clock in the morning. But I managed to send the fire engines and everything. They managed to get in, got the fire out, and managed to get the family out and keep them safe and stuff. So it's stuff like that that is really rewarding. Don't get me wrong, during that call it is very intense, and it's quite, your heart's racing. I never really understood the adrenaline that you would feel from that, but being on the phone with them and knowing that, and you're on the phone with them till the crews actually get them and have got them, and you know they're safe, and being able to experience that and like kind of know that you've essentially helped, like you've helped them, you've kind of not saved your life, but you have provided help to save their life. Do you know what I mean? So
like, really, you haven't?
Yeah,
you've all played an incredibly large part in it. No, I wouldn't do yourself down in that. You've saved their life.
But stuff like that is just, it's very rewarding. And I think I've been used to people from the charity calling and really hard times in the hospital, and children are really unwell, and providing support through the phone that way, or going to see them and being there for the support. So it felt very natural to go into this job. I'm just pleased and really thankful that I'm in this job. It's such a great job to be in. My work have been incredible. I don't have one bad word to say about them. I had my wee boy, obviously, had a couple of operations and stuff this year, and I was really worried about, because I wasn't long into the job, but they were just incredibly supportive and just helped me along the way, and tell me just take as much time off that you need to, if he was in hospital and stuff like that. So, and that was really good. I think that really made me realise that these people aren't just like, it's not a job for these people, and you spend like your shifts basically are 2 day shifts and 2 night shifts. So your 2 day shift is 2 10-hours and then it's 2 14-hours. So it's long shifts, but everybody in your, like, your watch is what you call it, like the people you work with, like basically like your family. You spend more time, I would say that you spend more time with them on a weekly basis than you do your actual family, because you're there with them for 48 hours a week, which is, and it's non-stop. So, but it's good, like, I get along with everyone, and it is, like, everybody supports each other, and that's when I realised that, you know what, like, the Scottish Fire Service is really like a family, because they do look out for everybody and they do support you, and they've been so great with me, and also everything that's happened with my family. So it's been great. I've really enjoyed it, and I look forward to hopefully many long years with them. So
brilliant. That's brilliant. And just very quickly before we wrap up, speaking of family, you became a father for the first time around, yep, sort of 15 or so months ago.
Yeah.
And your son also has Hirschsprungs as well. So what has that been like, being a father with Hirschsprungs and having a son with Hirschsprungs as well?
It's definitely been an eye-opener. we were unsure if we'd be able to actually have a child, and being brutally honest, I was under the impression that we didn't know if we'd be able to have a child naturally due to all my medications and antibiotics and x-rays and everything else. So we were kind of very much expecting that, and kind of told that we'd most likely probably need to go down the IVF route if we wanted to have a family, which we were completely fine with, and we knew that was a possibility. So when we were thinking about having Mateo, we were fully expecting it was going to be, you need to try for a year and then you would need to go through that whole process. So we were willing to do that, and then we didn't. It happened naturally, and we didn't need to go through the IVF route, which we were extremely blessed and thankful for. We were very, very much under the impression that there was a chance Mateo was going to have first sprungs. My mum had Martin, then B, and then after my mum had me, we had my younger sister who had passed away, unfortunately, at nine weeks old. But she passed away a cot death. It wasn't anything to do with her sprungs. But she had long segment her sprungs. So, and then she had went on to have my younger brother, Micah, who's now 15, going to be 16 next week, and he's completely healthy. So my mum had two with and two without. So we were very much under the impression if we have a kid, we probably will have her sprung, but we wouldn't know until he'd born. Which we knew that was the case. So when he was born, as soon as he was born, he said that he sounded like he had good bowel movements. As soon as he was born, he still hadn't passed meconium at the, like a few hours, he still hadn't passed it. And then I want to say it was about 24 hours, he still hadn't passed any. And that's when they took him over to the NICU. And we kind of knew that he had horse sprungs, but he was defying the odds because we thought it was short segment. Well, we were very much under the impression it was going to be short segment because he was still actually managing to go to the toilet, which was surprising, even though his bowel, obviously he's missing part, like functioning parts of his bowel. So we thought if he was managing to do that, then he must have short segment. Fast forward 9 weeks later, we went home and he was on bowel washouts and stuff, but he was still having like bowel movements out with the washouts, so we weren't needing to, like, he was still managing to go to the toilet without us intervening. So he went in for 8-9 weeks of operation expecting it to be short segment, and the doctor came back out and said that they'd not found any functioning bowel the whole length of his colon, and they were 20 centimetres into his small bowel at this point, and they still didn't know if it was any. So we couldn't believe that because he was still having bowel movements, which just didn't make sense. So they basically, like, and they didn't understand it either. So he has no parts of his colon work, and he's 30 centimetres into his small bowel that doesn't work. So he had basically 130 centimetres of dead bowel that he was managing to push basically his toilet out of, which they just did, and he was farting as well. So, like, they just did not, they had no idea how he managed, because he was doing it himself for 9 weeks. They just didn't understand. So as you can imagine, they were shocked, surprised at the fact when we went in there to receive, hopefully, which was going to be a simple procedure of going in, taking out the small part, being on our way, but instead it was, he'd need to have a stomach bag and he'd need to come back in when he's 1 year old to then get it all reversed and everything, because they basically said that he was classed as ultra long segment horse lungs, so past the total colonic, because he's not got, like, he's now into the small bowel. So, but he'd been amazing, like, he'd managed to, my wife said it to her, she's like still breastfeed him, so he would breastfed as a baby, and then he was completely breastfed, which is something that I was never able to do, and managing to tolerate milk and keep it down and everything, which we were so pleased with. And when the doctor came and sat us down and said, I'm really sorry that, you know, like, he's got horse sprungs and his quality of life isn't, like, we don't know what it'll be like and stuff, and he might have a stoma for the rest of his life. And like I kind of said, I don't think you actually realise that the fact that, like, we were very much under the impression that he would have her sprung, but the fact that every, at Christmas time, I know that my wife's going to be sitting there, I said, my son's going to be eating, I was like, that is, like, the best case scenario that I could ever hope for my son. And she was a bit taken aback. She was like, I never really realised it, never viewed it like that. I was like, I've never had the privilege of being able to sit down and have a meal. I was like, but now that I know when we go out to, like, the restaurants and out for dinner, like, my wife will have my son that's going to be able to sit down and eat a meal with her. I was like, that's like, I can't ask for any more. And people with horse sprungs have a very perfectly normal life.
Yeah.
So, and I'm on the very extreme side of it, and I've had like 85 operations and everything, and I'm on my TPN and everything for 12 hours. But like, I live a amazing life, in my opinion. Like, I go to football. Sometimes I play football with my friends. I've got a job. I work. Like, I've got a car. I've got a house. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I live a completely normal life from when they told me that I wouldn't. So the fact that worst case scenario for Mateo is he's not got his domain anymore. That got reversed, and he's doing amazing. He's doing amazing without his stoma. He's only going to the toilet like 4 or 5 times a day, which is like a normal, like Hirschsprung's, they would class that a baby. So like, he's been incredible, and he eats like an absolute tank. But yeah, he's been amazing, and it's been great to kind of go through the journey of fatherhood. I don't think the doctors are a bit not sure at times, obviously, because me and Leanne are so experienced, didn't know exactly what we're talking about, and in my opinion, we pushed for everything that's right. They didn't really want to feed him when he was only a week old, and said, oh no, we don't want to feed him. But I was like, no, like, let's feed him, let's see how he can do. And obviously that was like, and now that was the catalyst for back then, and they were shocked that we're managing to keep everything down and doing so well. So he was in the hospital for the first 2 weeks of his life. And we were in Ronald McDonald, and then he came home at 2 weeks old, went back in at seven weeks later when he was 9 weeks old to have that one, and then went back in when he was a year old to get his stoma reversed and to take the whole colon away and everything else. And unfortunately, there was complications in that operation, so we needed to then go back in 3-4 weeks later to then go in and get his stoma removed. Permanently removed again, because he couldn't do it because of the complications. But since then, he'd been completely fine, and he's now 15. Well, he'll be 15 months next week, and he's great. So yeah, it's been amazing. I'm just thankful for everything in life. So yeah, I'm just
fantastic.
Glad everything's going well.
That's fantastic. That's a lovely sentiment to think. To finish on, so thank you ever so much. And just my last little question, where can people find Samuel Smiles, find the charity?
Yeah, if you just go into Google and just type in Samuel Smile, I'm sure it'll pop up. And if you can't, if you're not sure, it's www.samuels.smile.co.uk, or if you just go on Facebook and type in Samuel Smile, it's I'll pop up with the name Samuel Bell, but that is a charity page, so you can just add me on that as well. And if there's anybody listening that has any questions about anything, about Hirschsprung's or anything like that, then feel free to just go and send me a message, and I'll offer any help or support, or if you want to chat or anything like that, I'm always available.
Awesome. Well, thank you ever so much for joining me, and I know it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, thank you so, so much for the Samuel Smiles charity. And for everybody you help.
No, thank you, Tom. No, I appreciate you having me on, and hopefully do it again sometime.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hirschsprung's Hour on UK Health Radio. You can find me on Facebook under Tom's Hirschsprung's Podcast, or Instagram on Tom's_Hirschsprung's_podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll bring you another episode soon.